Members, I'm going to call the Committee on Health and Human Services Reform to order. We have a quorum present, so our first order of business is going to be approve the minutes from February 25th. Would somebody be willing to make that motion? Representative Albright moves the minutes of February 25th. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails. And members, I am going to turn the gavel over to Representative Peterson as I have the first bill up.
Members, today we have Representative Maxville, House File 960, regarding social work board licensing provisions. And Representative Mack, would you like to move your bill and begin your presentation?
Yes, Madam Chair. I will move House File 960 be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance.
Thank you very much. And I understand you also have an amendment as well.
So I do, the A1 amendment in members' packets. I would like to move the A1.
Members, any questions on the amendment?
And Madam Chair, I can just, it's a extremely technical amendment, just to kind of clean up the bill and put it in a little bit of a better working order for the sake of those drafting the bill. So I don't know if research just wants to speak to that quickly, if members have questions, but it's just technical in nature.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I see that the amendment has a repealer in it, and it would be nice if maybe staff could tell us what's being repealed.
Go ahead, Madam Chair and Representative Liebling. There is already a repealer in the bill that's described in the summary for Section 148E.060, Subdivision 12. The sections in the subdivisions related to 148E.075 are in the bill, and those subdivisions were stricken in the bill, so they're available for you to review. The reason this amendment was drafted is because the reviser publishes a document at the end of each session that notes all the changes to statutes that have been made. Without adding these subdivisions to an official repealer, the repeal of them would not be noted in the reviser system.
Thank you, Ms. Saves. Any other further questions? Seeing none, so we can get your bill in the form you'd like it to be. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Motion prevails. All right. Representative Mack.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'll be brief in my comments and then turn it over to Ms. Acropate for more explanation of the bill. But members, this is a bill brought by the Board of Social Work, and basically what it is doing is trying to just address some housekeeping issues within the Board of Social Work. It's got some creative solutions to some of the ongoing challenges that the board's been facing over the past several years. It also addresses some of the goals that have been put forward by the mental health the Minnesota Workforce on Mental Health and trying to improve access to more folks by making sure that we have some additional licensing options for social workers. And so it's a pretty straightforward bill, not controversial, a lot of support from the Professional Association. And so with that, I will turn it over to Ms. Acropate to give some more details on what's entailed in the bill.
Ms. Acropate.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Representative Mack. Good afternoon, Chair and members. I'm Kate Zacherpate. I'm the Executive Director of the Board of Social Work, and the Board really appreciates this opportunity to present the Board's bill, House File 960. And again, just thank you to Representative Mack for authoring this bill and to all the other representatives who did sign on to provide their support. I'll give you just a really brief background about the Board of Social Work. Again, the board was created in 1987, and we have a core public safety mission, and that is to keep Minnesotans safe. To do that, we ensure that licensed social workers are qualified, ethical, and accountable, and that they adhere to professional standards of practice. That essentially is our mission. The board currently licenses over 13,800 social workers who meet standards at four different license types, and those are both at the bachelor's and the graduate degree level. We investigate and resolve complaints against social workers and their practice. We educate social workers and citizens about the board and about licensing responsibilities in our state. And the board, as you may know, receives no general fund dollars. We're entirely fee supported. The first thing that I do want to mention after a conversation with Representative Mack today is that there is nothing in this bill whatsoever that would seek to change the current licensing exemption for county social workers. You know, as I looked at this, if you were to do a word search, you would not find the word county in this bill. So to address, you know, concerns and questions that I heard a few members had, what I really want to address today is why these policy changes are important and why they are needed in 2015. These policy changes, in the board's opinion, are really innovative, and they are practical reforms. They will have a positive impact for the citizens of Minnesota, for the board, and for licensees as well. Again, as Representative Mack said, these proposals are non-controversial, and they really are very well supported by the professional associations as well. And what I will do is just sort of briefly run through the sections of the bill for you. The first section amends the inactive license provisions that we have in statute. And very, very importantly, this is one of the innovative changes. The proposal is to create a new emeritus active license. And then another very intentional thing about this particular section, as you sort of look at it, you will notice a fair amount of strikeouts. And we are intentionally reorganizing this section to make it much more clear, we hope, and user-friendly. So again, this active emeritus license really responds to the mental health workforce shortages by creating a licensing option for retired social workers so they can engage in pro bono or volunteer practice, or they are able to engage in paid practice and provide licensing supervision, which is a very important core requirement for the Board of Social Work licensees and other mental health professionals. And again, we recognize that there is a bit of a shortage of individuals who are qualified and able to provide licensing supervision. As Representative Mack mentioned, this is also a very specific recommendation that's included in the 2015 Minnesota Mental Health Workforce Development Plan. This license will continue to maintain standards for practitioners. It's a renewable license. Individuals must obtain continuing education. And so this is one provision that really feels very innovative. Section 2 and 3 amends the current reactivation section. And the amendments here are only with the intent of making the necessary technical changes to ensure that we've got accurate cross-sections, cross-references is what I meant to say, based on the changes in Section 1 of the bill. Section 4 and 5 does create two new licenses that are necessary to support the new policy that the board is moving forward. So again, Section 4 includes the new fee for the Emeritus Active License, and the incentive for this particular new license that we're really hoping will be utilized is that the board is building in a 50% reduction in the current licensing fee as an incentive to try to keep retired social workers active and contributing to the workforce. Section 5, again, includes the new fee and a change to the fee section. This will create a new license late fee, is what we are calling this, which is actually an administrative fee that can be used as a non-disciplinary option to resolve some unlicensed practice cases. This would clearly better balance enforcement with unlicensed practice violations, and it's an additional tool by which the board could help to reduce legal expenditures, expedite resolutions, and to really create efficiencies. And I might also just note that the two new fees that I'm referencing in Section 4 and Section 5 have been included in House File 850 and Senate File 825, the budget bills. So they are included in that as well. Lastly, what I will tell you about is the amendment to the temporary license provision. And the intent here is to repeal what is in statute right now as an automatic ineligibility provision. Excuse me, and I'll explain this a little bit. Under current law, this particular subdivision requires the board to automatically deny an application for a temporary license even when an applicant is meeting all the standards of education, examination, and background checks if they are already engaged in a social work practice position when they apply for the temporary license. So again, repealing this subdivision really will help to remove and address an unintended consequence. It will eliminate a current barrier to obtain a temporary license and allow social workers to enter the workforce readily. And again, if we repeal this particular subdivision, Subdivision 12, it will allow the board to grant temporary licenses to applicants who meet all of the standards, but, you know, by omission or however that has occurred, they've already taken the temporary or taken a social work practice position and therefore under current law have rendered themselves ineligible. The temporary license has been in place for a number of years, and overall the temporary license allows the board to expedite licenses for new graduates, members of the military and their families, and professionals relocating to Minnesota. This change to repeal this particular subdivision really will provide for a less restrictive regulation while still maintaining the necessary standards. So that's the summary that I can provide you about the provisions in the bill. I appreciate very much the opportunity to present the board's bill, and the board would ask for your support of House File 960, and I'd be very happy to take any questions. Thank you.
Thank you for your very clear and thorough explanation of the bill. Are there any questions from members? Representative Quam?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And a couple of things that are fairly related. First, just the curiosity of unlicensed, how often do people just start practicing before receiving a license? Is this frequent or rare?
Ms. Zacherpate?
Thank you, Chair and Representative Quam. We are finding that we are finding about 40 of those cases per year. Clearly, it is not a real high occurrence, but it does occur. And the board is obligated to enforce the statute and to respond to unlicensed practice. The board clearly, for the last probably 15 years, has really been involved in a pretty strong campaign. And we go out to each and every one of the universities in the state of Minnesota who have social work programs to inform students about their licensing responsibilities. You know, and yet sometimes that does happen. And so, again, this license late fee really gives the board an additional tool that does not exist currently to deal with these cases in a non-disciplinary way.
Representative Quam?
Thank you. And by additional tool, that means that the existing tool is still in the toolbox for utilization for something that is much more, okay, I see the nod on that. Moving into the other area, you've got temporary leave license where you can be out for 4 years and then not greater than 60 days. And I'm curious what continuing education training is needed during that time if you've got a temporary leave license. And similarly, if you're emeritus coming back and you've been retired for several years, I only see 20 hours for that. So I'm trying to understand, if you've been out for years, how much do they really have to go through because things change?
Ms. Zacher-Pate.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Quam. To reactivate a license from the current temporary leave and the inactive emeritus, those provisions have been in law for, I believe, since the inception of licensing, 89, and they're utilized pretty well. When you're putting your license on hold, essentially, to return to practice, you do need to document continuing ed, as you said. That's one of the mechanisms. And what is required is that you will need to document the same amount of continuing ed as if you had a regular active status license, which is 40 hours over a two-year period. So that applies as the requirement to temporary leave and the emeritus inactive. Clearly, the person has to go through an application process, has to respond to ethical background questions. So those mechanisms are in place as oversight to help ensure that people meet standards and are competent to return to practice. The 20 hours that you referenced is the new provision that we are building in for the emeritus active license. That is a little bit different because with the emeritus active license, how we have created this is that you are currently engaged in practice. This is a license that you must renew every 2 years. So while you might be not practicing in a full-time capacity, you are still, you know, practicing on an ongoing basis. And one of the incentives for that was to reduce the continuing ed from 40 hours from essentially somebody who is practicing full-time to 20 hours over that two-year period. But continuing ed is certainly a tool that we utilize to ensure that licensed social workers are keeping up with practice modalities.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the clarification on those details.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any other testimony from the audience that would like to say something on this bill? All right, seeing none, Representative Mack renews her motion that the A1 amendment be adopted, or the House File 960 as amended be re-referred to the Health and Human Services Finance Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed say no. Motion prevails. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Okay, members, next we'll have Representative Krisha come for House File 753. And Representative Krisha, I will move your bill, House File 753, be re-referred to the Greater Minnesota Economic and Workforce Development Policy Committee. Representative Krisha, to your bill.
And thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you again, committee members. It's just a very simple bill. What we're trying to do as we're working with social workers and child protection and the areas of mental health out in Greater Minnesota is just trying to get more social workers out to those areas. And one of the means by which we can do that is a loan forgiveness program. And so I offer that for your consideration. We still have a couple of things, technical things that I have found that I'll be working on between the two committees, but I guess what I'm looking for is an endorsement of the idea so I can work on those between now and HHS Finance.
Thank you, Representative Krisha. Is there anyone in the audience who wants to testify to House File 753? Ms. Abderholden, if you want to come forward. And if you could introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony and have about 2 to 3 minutes.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, members. Sue Abderholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota. And I just wanted to voice our support for this bill for House File 753. As you know, we have a workforce development plan gearing up for action. It's an excellent report, really provides some very clear steps that we can take to improve our mental health workforce and try to, especially in rural Minnesota. You know, people hear a lot about the fact that we don't have enough psychiatrists in Minnesota, but actually we don't have enough mental health professionals across the board, and that would include licensed social workers. So, again, this is a great step forward. We hope that you actually expand access to mental health services this session, and in order to do that, we need more mental health professionals. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Liebling has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Kreisha, I think this is a great idea. And I'm sure you know there are a number of bills moving that do something similar, expanding the loan forgiveness program. And those are really great. I think this is a proven way to get people into underserved areas and so on. And we all know that younger folks are carrying incredibly heavy debt burdens. So this is it's a win-win. The only thing I am really concerned about is that there won't be enough money allocated, and I know this isn't the Finance Committee, but I just want to really just say on the record that I really hope that we can get enough financing for this bill and the others. I know they overlap to some degree, but to get enough money into this whole area of loan forgiveness that will actually be meaningful and not just diluting the amounts that are available by putting more and more people in eligible, because that would just create a lot of disappointment. So I think this is a really great policy, and just really want to see it funded at a level that will be meaningful for all these new categories of practitioner. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Question from Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Kreisha, I'm just wondering, because most of the other professionals that are covered by these programs are sort of limited in number, whereas social workers could end up to be a pretty big group of people. Are you thinking of narrowing it from every social worker to a certain category of them, or is this going to be all of the possible ones out there?
Representative Kreisha.
And thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Mullery. So the answer to that is yes, yes, and probably yes again. And the reason I say all that is because Senator Rosen is carrying the compliment, and she actually asked me to carry this in the House, and she's been working on this as well. So we're trying to narrow that scope to see where it's going to fit. I don't have any definite answers yet. I'm hoping to get that worked out between her and I and the next committee.
And
Representative
Chair,
Mullery.
And Representative Kreisha, I know she talked to me about that a little bit in our subcommittee on the Abuse Task Force, because we're seeing 18-year-olds doing what master's degree people should be doing and ended up with a lot of problems in that. And so if it's to get more, for instance, social workers that in that particular field, I certainly think we need to do it. But I think right now it seems awfully expansive, and I'm not sure if you want to go there.
Representative Kreisha.
And thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Mullery, as you know, I mean, we talk. I'd love to hear those suggestions, and we should talk some more.
Any other questions, members? Seeing none, I will renew my motion that House File 753 be re-referred to the Committee on Greater Minnesota Economic and Workforce Development Policy Committee. A ridiculously long name for a committee. All of those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails. And Representative Kreisha, you have one other bill up in a similar vein, House File 803. Members, I will move that House File 803 be re-referred to the Committee on Greater Minnesota and Economic and Workforce Development Policy Committee. Representative Kreisha, to your bill.
And thank you, Madam Chair. And one quick oral amendment, if I could, of a technical nature. On line 1.22, it was pointed out to me that that subdivision should be 18 and not 8.
Okay, so Representative Kreisha is moving an oral, a technical oral amendment on line 1.22. It should read subdivision 18. Does everybody have that oral amendment? Okay, members, if those in favor of the amendment, please say aye.
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 Those opposed, no. The motion prevails. Representative Kreisha, to your bill as amended.
And so everything I already said applies. And the reason why there's two here, to be honest, is I'm not sure if Senator Rosen wants two bills or if she just wrote them quickly to split them up, but it would be my intention to take the ideas of both of these and to put them together in one good idea that limits the scope and sequence that we can find the funding for. I apologize that I have to take your time up with two bills, but sometimes the senators don't always listen to me. Did I say that in the microphone?
Yeah. Any questions? Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Kreisha. I know you've spent a lot of time looking at the child protection issue and know that this is a major issue. What I have heard is that actually the caseloads that are the greatest are and most need to be adjusted are in the metro area, and that the metro area is having a hard time recruiting and retaining social workers in this area, particularly people of color or Native American backgrounds, some of the groups that we see disproportionately represented in this. And so I'm wondering if you could explain to me why you felt that this should not be available to them as they attempt to try and create a more culturally sensitive and adequately staffed system.
Representative Kreisha.
And thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the question. It was not an intentional in any way, and I could certainly have that conversation if they're between the two of us, between the next two committees. If you think there's improvements to the bill, I'd be more than happy to take those on an amendment moving forward.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and based on that, I won't move to change the language as it is right now, but I think we can work together on this because I think it is a major challenge statewide, quite honestly, and I'm glad that the governor is likely to recommend additional resources so that there will be hiring going on throughout the state so we can do a better job here. Thank you.
Any other questions, members? Oh, Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Kreisha, I hope you'll work with me, too, because that's part of our, we're both on the same abuse task force, and you're not on the committee that's seeing all of the problems like I am, but we have the problems in the metro area, too, believe me. And I know you're on the other committee that doesn't see those much, but I think we need to look at this for everywhere in the metro to make sure that we're getting at this issue that we're... Child abuse is everywhere, and the lack of social workers to handle it is everywhere. And so with that, I hope you'll work with us on going ahead.
Representative Kreisha, to that point?
And just absolutely. And there's no intention of not being considered of the entire state, and we both know the scope of this problem, so absolutely.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Kreisha, as we've talked about these loan forgiveness ideas over time, one of the reasons that I recall that they we know that they have a very good track record of getting people into shortage areas. There's no question about that. But part of that is that we usually see data about what the average debt load is for certain occupations and where there are shortages and so on. And I totally am behind you in your putting forward the need to have more people work in the field of child protection, because we know it's an extraordinarily difficult area to work in, and I can only imagine how stressful it must be and so on. But I wonder if you have any data about how much of a debt load these people are carrying, because I think that feeds into whether this is an effective policy. And it's great to, you know, want to reward people for doing difficult work, but when we're talking about loan forgiveness, the real question is, do they have high loans such that this is likely to be an effective policy as it has been for other people? So I wonder if you can address that at all.
Representative Kreisha.
And thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Liebling. To that point, I actually have a couple of handouts that Representative Schumacher is going to send down, and you're welcome to have copies of those. Those came from the Minnesota Department of Health, and I believe all the data that you're asking for is included in there.
Okay.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you. I take it then the answer is yes, we have the data, and I'll take a look, and thank you.
Well, technically not yet, but I think you're like six people away.
Thank you, Representative Liebling, for your faith in Representative Kreisha. Any other questions, members? Seeing none, I will renew my motion that House File 803 be referred to the committee, to the Greater Minnesota Economic and Workforce Development Policy Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails.
Once again, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Kreisha. Okay, members, next we have Representative Zerwas with House File 644. And Representative Zerwas, if you want to move your bill, and then I understand you have an amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'll move House File 644 to be referred to Committee on Government Operations.
Okay, and Representative Zerwas to the A1 amendment.
Yep, we have a technical amendment for the A1 amendment to get it in the shape which I'd like to present the bill.
Okay, members, Representative Zerwas moves the A1 amendment. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Zerwas, to the bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, joining me a little bit later will be Jason Erickson of the American Massage Therapy Association, Minnesota chapter, Chuck Sawyers, the Senior Vice President of Northwestern Health Sciences University, and Gary Myers with Massage Envy. And to a little bit of background, this legislation has been in process for nearly a decade, where they've been meeting with stakeholders and coming in front of these committees for feedback. And this legislation would create a uniform, voluntary registration process that will provide peace of mind for clients, employers, and healthcare professionals that they're working with to find vetted professionals who are bound to enforce a standard of conduct, meet certain educational standards, pass background checks as required. The bill grants these qualified registered massage and bodywork therapists the title protection of the RMBT designation. The profession of massage and bodywork therapy is practiced by more than 5,200 individuals in Minnesota. A real need exists for state regulation, as Minnesota is one of only five, including all of our neighbor states, that do not regulate or license massage therapists. This proposal was reviewed by the Minnesota Council of Health Boards during a six-month process, and the report found that there is an overall compelling state interest in regulating this industry to protect public health and safety from the actions of unqualified, unethical, improperly trained practitioners who are not currently regulated proactively on a statewide basis. In your packets, you'll find an article from this weekend Star Tribune that talks about Minneapolis massage ordinance puts a dent in sex trafficking, and that's an example of regulation on a local level helping with this industry. Passage of this bill will help law enforcement across the state fight sex trafficking as well. The League of Minnesota Cities also is in support of this legislation. This bill will also assure Minnesotans that registered massage therapists and bodywork artists have met educational requirements. We have 33 schools in Minnesota that are training students. And I know we've all gotten information saying there's a push by a handful of schools to try to make money. I just want to stress this. We have 33 schools in Minnesota that are training students. All of these school program hours exceed the minimum education standards found in this bill. So this bill is not set up to give one program or one institution an advantage over the other. This bill, the standards in this bill, would be met by the current 33 programs in Minnesota. It's good for business. On average, massage and bodywork therapists work in two practice locations and are currently required to be licensed or registered in multiple locations for cities that have local ordinances. For that process, they wait for multiple weeks up to multiple months. They pay fees in each location which they intend to work. This singular state voluntary registration credential would dramatically simplify the regulatory burden on these small business professionals. Those massage and bodywork therapists wish to remain practicing as they do today under 146A may continue to do so now and into the future. This legislation will not change that. They can continue their practice. If they're practicing under a city license, they can keep doing that. If they're practicing under an athletic trainer registration, they can continue doing that. If they're practicing under a nursing license, they can continue doing that. If they're practicing under a physical therapist license, they can continue doing that. I would ask for your support in this voluntary registration meant to streamline the process and simplify and lift some regulatory burdens for people or business owners that are trying to either work in multiple cities that have ordinances or trying to have a business in multiple jurisdictions in order to have the flexibility to move employees around. There are currently 200 openings across Minnesota for massage and body therapists that are waiting to be filled, and they believe strongly that the need and the push to have to jump through hoops to be able to work in multiple cities is a reason why someone will say, you know what, I'm not going to go through all that hassle. You know, I practice in Maple Grove. I'm not going to go through all that hassle just so I can pick up one or two shifts a week at the Massage Envy and Rogers. It's just not worth it. You know, I'll try to pick up a shift once in a while at my current location. This would lift that burden and allow people to register with one entity and have that covered across. And if you don't want to register and you want to keep doing exactly what you're doing today, this bill would allow you to do that. Members, honestly, I don't know how the heck I got into carrying this bill. I've never had a massage.
What?
The idea of a stranger touching me creeps me out. I'm here solely for the practice that we need to allow independent practitioners, give them the most flexibility and freedom as possible, and business owners the most flexibility possible to staff their business. And with that, we have some people standing by for questions if need be. Otherwise, I think there are some other testifiers.
Thank you, Representative Zuroz. Members, we're going to move to our testifiers first, and then we will take questions at the end. The first person we have is Greg Schmidt. Our first one is Gary Myers, and Greg Schmidt is on deck. So if Gary Myers is here. Mm-hmm. Welcome to the committee. If you could introduce yourself and then proceed with your testimony, and each testifier has a max of 3 minutes. If you could
Madam
proceed.
Chair, thank you. My name is Gary Myers. I'm the regional developer for Massage Envy in the state of Minnesota, South Dakota, and North Dakota, actually. But I want to speak mainly about Minnesota. I developed over 22 in the metro area, 22 massage envies. We currently employ over 500 therapists in the state of Minnesota. We are the largest employer of massage therapists in the state of Minnesota. And actually, we're the largest employer of massage therapists in the United States, Massage Envy as a corporate is. And some of the issues, I have in front of me here a list that we've compiled because this has been an ongoing issue, but it shows what cities have registration and what cities have city licensure. Half of them have registration, half of them have city licensure. They all require background checks. Okay. As a franchise owner, I have multiple franchisees myself. I own three clinics myself. I own one in Roseville, Blaine, and Woodbury. Okay. I cannot take one of my employed massage therapists and move them to another clinic, even though they work for me and my corporation. Okay, many of our franchise owners out there have the same problem. Not only is this an issue with us, but the massage therapists, they would like to pick up, a lot of them are part-time, they'd like to pick up more hours, and they are restricted from doing so. It needs to be corrected. I would appreciate if you would really look at that. Currently, right now, we can employ another 100 massage therapists. We have job openings for them currently. That's all. Any questions? I'd be happy to address.
Thank you, Mr. Myers. Question for the testifier, Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Myers, could you just be more specific about how this bill addresses the problem that you've just identified? Does this, if somebody's registered under this bill, does it preempt the local registration so that they can just go ahead and practice at any of your locations? Is that what the bill does?
That is correct. Mayor. Registration lets them work in any city. They don't have to go from one city to another to get a background check. Once they're registered, they've got their background check, they're approved, they can work in any city in the state.
Thank you, Mr. Meyer. Appreciate you being here today.
Thank you so much.
Our next testifier is Greg Schmidt. If you could introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Madam Chair, and members, my name is Gregory Schmidt. I am a board member of Minnesota Integrative Care Advocates, the natural health proponents of integrative health care. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on House File 644. Recently, this committee heard a long testimony by the Office of Legislative Auditor about MNSHR. The committee had high praise for the Office of Legislative Auditor, which they should. They do excellent work. In 1998, the same similar report was done by the Office of Legislative Auditor about occupational regulation. I've had the staff include the review of that, the executive summary of that in your packets. It's very pertinent information even now, even though that report was done a number of years ago. Unfortunately, nobody who was in the department and wrote that report at the time is still there, so there's nobody here to answer any questions that you might have about that. The question I pose to you is, why would the legislature request and fund such a report and then largely ignore it? It is an important document, especially given that for the members of this committee, this is usually the first stop in a health occupations proposal, regulatory proposal. This report references Minnesota Statute 214 extensively. As Chapter 214 is the foundation stone for our rationale for how the legislature considers occupational regulation here in Minnesota. I will reference several key aspects of the OLA report and how it pertains to this bill and how on some levels this bill is at least a violation of the spirit, if not the intent, of Chapter 214. The first line of the report, the statutory purpose of occupational regulation is to protect public health, safety, and welfare. Further, on page 11, the regulatory policy articulated by Chapter 214 recognizes the potential danger of occupational fencing, which is elaborated on in the prior paragraph. It challenges proponents of regulation to demonstrate that the regulation serves public interest. Our contention is that this bill is a practitioner bill. In Minnesota, registration is also called title protection. The report goes on to suggest several different options that this committee or the legislature could use in order to review requests for occupational regulation. However, it acknowledges that outside influence, more than the concerns of the agencies or public outcry relating to harm, interferes with the process, a wise and thoughtful examination of the need for any such regulation. In point of fact, the national groups who have pushed for regulation, usually licensure in Minnesota and other states, have spent, during the time I've been working in healthcare issues over here, over $200,000 on direct lobbying. Our contention is that this investment was to garner a much bigger payback to the proponents and very little benefit to Minnesota consumers. I refer you to page 15, paragraph 1. The basic thrust of the statute, and they're referring to chapter 214, is the burden of proof is on the proponents of regulation to make a case for that regulation. A threat to public health or safety must be shown to be immediate, my caps. Now,
Mr. Schmidt, I'll have to ask you to wrap up here pretty quickly.
I'm almost there. The statutory regulations under Chapter 146 are working to protect consumers. Per the requirements of Chapter 214, no additional regulations are necessary or warranted. I'll take any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Schmidt. I don't see any questions at this point, but if you hang around and some come up later, that would be helpful. Our next testifier is Chuck Sawyer. Welcome to the committee. If you could introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Dr. Chuck Sawyer, and I'm with Northwestern Health Sciences University in Bloomington, Minnesota. You've all heard the saying, there are two things you can count on in life, and those being death and taxes. I'm going to add a third, and that's that annually a broad coalition of clinicians and educators and other advocates are bringing to the legislature again a bill to enact a statute that would bring massage therapists under a statewide regulation mechanism. And we've been at this, as others have mentioned, for going on 10 years. This bill has been the subject of a lot of discussion, a great deal of compromise. The 30-odd some academic institutions who are only part of this picture have not always been in agreement in the past, but have reached a lot of compromise and enthusiasm for this bill now over the last couple of years and are here together to support that. You've got a fact sheet that I think recites all the reasons why this is good public policy, but I want to just call your attention again to the Star Tribune article, and I want to do this and have you picture in your mind's eye three YouTube videos, one from the Mayo Clinic, and a physician by the name of Dr. Brent Bauer, who is an internist and director of their integrative medicine unit, and two others from Emory University and the University of Kentucky. All three are talking about the clinical benefits and the research that substantiates the contention that massage therapy is a healthcare profession. there is considerable data now in the literature that documents the variety of benefits, stress reduction, improving the immune function of the body, aiding in the healing process postoperatively, and that is on this end of the continuum. While the Star Tribune article about the ordinance passed in Minnesota, in Minneapolis, is over here, this profession is moving very rapidly to the Mayo Clinic, Emory University, University of Kentucky, and a variety of hospitals in the Twin Cities, including Abbott Northwestern. We would encourage you to support this bill and pass it out of this committee. It's about time that we had a statewide regulation mechanism that, as others have mentioned, is voluntary. And we would encourage you to pass this legislation. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mr. Sawyer. Any questions at this point for the testifier? Seeing none, our next testifier is Catherine Berg. And on deck will be Barbara York. Welcome to the committee. If you could introduce yourself and proceed.
I will. Situated here. Okay, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I am Catherine Berg, and I am a board member with the Minnesota Integrative Care Advocates, and I'm also a classical homeopath. So I practice legally in Minnesota under Minnesota Statute 146A, which currently covers massage therapists in Minnesota. Thank you for allowing me to testify in opposition to HF 644. The reason being is that it casts too wide a net. On page 3, section 3 of the bill, they define a massage therapy and body work. And it really covers a lot of modalities beyond massage therapy and body work. It includes aromatherapists because it's anyone who uses them not only to massage but to inhale. It includes anyone who uses creams, and not just massage-in creams, but uses them. And I'm showing you right here a cream that I would use in my business, and sometimes I have other specialized creams that my clients I use and I recommend for my clients. It means that healing touch, Reiki, Wallace method, rhythmic movement training, homeopaths, etc., would all be covered by this bill. I'm a homeopath. I use creams, as I said. Does the passage of this bill also mean that the person behind the makeup counter would also could also register as well, because they also use creams in their business, and they do recommend them for people. And they might even be health-related recommendations. So let's say I choose not to be grandfathered in when this bill passes. There's 2 years, I think, that I could be grandfathered in. In 3 years, the city of Woodbury, who does right now currently regulate their massage therapists, decides to require anyone who is doing massage or body work, as defined by this bill, must register. Suddenly, it's not voluntary anymore, is it? Now it's required. And suddenly, I can't practice homeopathy because I can't pass a body work test. I am not a body worker. And this would be true of aromatherapists, small Wallace method practitioners, Reiki, healing touch, all kinds of people that could conceivably be covered by this registration. There are probably others. For example, the amount of education required by reflexologists is about half of what's required in this. I've done some research online, and it's usually about half of what's required, and it's adequate. The only solution would be for me to go to a massage school, which I don't want to do, and it may be theoretical that a city would require that people register, but it is not theoretical that they could require it. So any city who currently has massage therapy regulation could say that if you want to practice in the city, you have to do the state registration. And suddenly it isn't voluntary anymore. Now it's required. The city of Minneapolis has a business license for their massage therapist, not a massage therapy license, and then suddenly they could have two requirements. So I encourage you to vote no on this. It simply casts too wide a net. And thank you. If anyone has any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you, Ms. Berg. Members, any questions at this time? Not at this point. Thank you so much for your testimony. And if there are any at the end, we'll bring you back forward. Our next testifier is Barbara York. Welcome to the committee. If you could introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Barbara York. I'm the president of the Minnesota Therapeutic Massage Network. We also call ourselves Touch Movement to incorporate people who do energy work and body work. I've been following massage bills for over three decades. Back in 1987, we examined the 214 and found that for practitioners, it would be great if we had a license, but for the consumer, it would be devastating. They would lose practitioners, there would be costs would go up, which are totally counter to the 214. There are situations placed here by employers and schools. For the employers, they can require any credentialing that they want. They can have it higher than if this bill were to pass. You could have to have a bachelor's degree. So for the employer, though it's touted as being important for them, it's not necessary for them to vet the employees that they will accept. As far as the voluntary mandatory, we just heard what that was happening. A lot of cities have occupational, not a lot. Some of the cities have occupational regulations. They could say, okay, we'll let this part go, but you have to have the state registration in exchange. But I do know that a lot of the cities have business license. Those are not going to go away. Bloomington has a business license. It's $545. You add the fees here onto that, and you can put people out of business because those are not going to go away. It's touted that it's going to clear this all out. I am assured by many cities that's not going to happen because they need their business license, regardless of who's working, to be able to knock and go in without having to get a warrant. When I started with this field, prostitution was the bigger issue that we were having to say, we are massage therapists, they are doing prostitution. There's a pharmacist and there's a drug dealer. You don't say illegitimate pharmacists any more than you say illegitimate massage therapists. What happens with that is that if the city goes up on sex trafficking, which is prostitution is local, sex trafficking is universal, a major problem, and that they have to be able to knock and go in right then. That's why the cities are not going to let go of business. I talked to Linda Roberts with the Minneapolis Division on Business Licensing, and she said there were lobbyists here from the cities, and I don't know if they're here. I don't know who they are, but they may be able to speak to that need, but clearly it's not going to go away. Minneapolis is only $50 for the individual, and that it includes the criminal background check. Some of the cities don't have that as free, but they do charge for that.
And Ms. York, I'll have to ask you to wrap up.
We are regulated under the 146A, which we passed in 2000. It meets the report that Greg Schmidt brought forth. There are no consumers at any of these meetings saying, I have been harmed. You look online, you'll see dissatisfaction, but that's like going to a mom-and-pop greasy spoon. They stored the eggs right, but they made a mess serving it to you. We are covered. We, as you see on our list of our history, we pass consumer protection laws. The 609, which makes anyone who does a criminal sexual activity with a client, they end up being a registered sex offender. The 146A and the 609 are adequate. The cities want their protection and their ability to knock and enter. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. York. Appreciate it.
I'm available for answering questions.
Thank you. Our next testifier is Jason Erickson. And then our final testifier will be Lee McGrath. Welcome to the committee. If you could introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jason Erickson. I am a massage therapist, currently president of the American Massage Therapy Association chapter here in Minnesota. I am also a co-owner of Keep in Touch Massage in Eagan, Minnesota. I'm a resident of Burnsville. I am a loving father, and I have many friends and family that have received a great deal of care from massage therapists. I'm a former chronic pain patient for which massage therapy in conjunction with other medical care was critical to me becoming pain-free. According to the American Massage Therapy Association, every year we do an industry survey and study what's going on in across the country. The number one reason why people across the country, including here in Minnesota, seek out the help of a massage therapist is due to pain. The folks that have spoken in opposition to this bill, they care very deeply about what's going on, okay, but I care no less. Those of us that have been working on behalf of this bill have been growing in number over the years. Over and over and over again, I hear from my colleagues across the state what's going on with the regulation in my area. My city doesn't have any regulation at all, and there's all these places popping up all over the place. I'm having trouble staying in business because these places are doing illegitimate things that make me look bad. I have people emailing me saying, I want to move to Minnesota. I'm licensed as a massage therapist in my state, and I want to work. What do I need to do? And I have to walk them through this, like, which city are they going to work, and explain the whole process. As a business owner, this regulation change would be an enormous benefit. Every year, our business is contacted by many corporate and private parties about providing massage therapy services at special events, at athletic events, and so forth. Due to the lack of a uniform statewide credential that would allow us to legally provide services in multiple cities, every year we're forced to turn away many thousands of dollars worth of contracts. The year that Apple Valley introduced its municipal ordinance regulating massage therapy, we were 2 weeks away from signing a contract with a business there to provide ongoing services. So the lack of a statewide regulation and the prevalence of municipal regulations that are completely different from city to city to city has been enormously taxing on our business, and it's been enormously taxing on the practices of many of my colleagues throughout the state. As you already heard from the representative from Massage Envy, their businesses are hurting. So passing this regulation is extremely business friendly in terms of both small businesses and large businesses. We all need it. Those who do not want to participate do not have to. There was a mention of a report that was regarding occupational regulation. I do want to point out that that the study referenced in this report was done in 1998. But it was in 2009 that another review found that there was compelling reason to license massage therapy here in Minnesota.
And Mr. Erickson, I'll need you to wrap up.
I could go on and on. I'm very passionate about this. You can probably feel it. I just want to project it all into you. So please vote to move this forward. Help us move this forward so we can all get on with doing the things that we do best and not take up more of your precious time here. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Erickson. Appreciate it. We have a question from Representative Mason for, I believe you, Mr. Erickson.
This is going to be a general.
Oh, okay. Sounds good. A question to the testifier. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, sir, I appreciate your testimony, but maybe I don't understand the bill. Because if this bill is voluntary, and if it doesn't preempt the business licenses that different cities may require, how does it solve the problem that you are bringing forward? I'm just not really seeing that this bill. I do recognize that there are these issues about different licenses in different places, but I really don't understand how this bill is going to fix that for you. Could you explain that?
Absolutely. So, for example, if you have a therapist that practices in one location, whether they do massage therapy or if they're some other type of bodywork practitioner, they can continue to practice just as they are. If they do not choose to become a registered massage and bodywork therapist, nothing changes for them. On the other hand, if they are like myself, who getting calls from businesses in adjoining cities, and it's cost prohibitive to go through the process of getting the licensing in multiple locations in order to take care of these additional business opportunities, which basically limits my ability to provide access to care in that area. It limits their ability to service their clients or employees, as the case may be, and it limits my ability to generate an income and keep my employees employed. So if I and my employees choose to participate in this, then we would be able to provide those services.
Yeah. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I was thinking about the other problem that you identified. You talked earlier about people moving in who weren't qualified, and that was impacting your business. And I was just thinking that this, since it's voluntary, that could still happen, right? I mean, this is not changing that, and it's not also changing the fact that if you want to start a new business in another place, that you have to comply with the license for that municipality, right?
Thank you for clarifying your question. There are cities in Minnesota, well, the city I practice in, Eagan, it's $25 a year for an individual practitioner to maintain their license. That's cheap. I'm not complaining about that at all. I like that. On the other hand, there are cities in Minnesota that charge in excess of $3,000 per year for an individual therapist to be able to practice. That's very, very difficult for a legitimate massage therapist to foot that bill year in and year out. And so what happens instead is that massage therapists will typically just locate to other cities, or they will be forced to make a choice between either not practicing that city at all or practicing under the radar, so to speak. So the thing is that if, on the other hand, this bill, one of the things it lays out is costs. So if a person wanted to be able to practice in one of those cities that had exorbitant local licensing fees, this might provide a more cost-effective alternative for them.
Well, Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I could ask Representative Zerwas, is that how the bill operates? Does it preempt, if a city is charging for a business license right now, does this bill preempt that if the person then is registered instead?
Representative Zerwas.
Madam Chair, members, to be clear, this would not alter a municipality's business license. This would work for municipalities or local jurisdictions that license individuals. or register individuals to have a criminal background check, prove that they have the necessary education requirement. So if a business says to operate a salon in the city of Elk River, you need a business license, and then along with that salon services, if you're going to be, because the beauticians within the salon would have a state license to do hair. If you offer massage in the city of Elk River, the individuals within that salon would have to be licensed within the city of Elk River. And so what this bill would do is say, I have the state licensure or the state registration. I meet all of your requirements. So what it frees up for people that operate, would like to operate in multiple communities, it gives them that flexibility. Or for business owners that have locations in multiple communities and want to be able to flex staff, it gives them that flexibility. But if you want to do what you're doing tomorrow, exactly what you're doing today, when this bill goes into effect, nothing will change.
One other question, Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think we're kind of getting into government operations territory, but I think it's also related to the public health authority of cities, so I think it's probably relevant to this committee, but I was going to wait until the end, but it's right on this point, too. And I think probably Representative Zerwa is the question's best directed at you. I think you said that the League of Minnesota Cities supports this, but I was wondering about the whole preemption issue, because if you look at the bill at line 15.3, it says that, you know, the bill preempts the licensure and regulation of registered massage and bodywork therapists by a municipality. So that seems like, including the ability to conduct a criminal background investigation, so that seems like pretty clear preemption language. But if you go down to line, starting at subdivision 2, it says nothing shall be construed to limit a municipality from several things, one of which, line 15.9, is obtaining, requiring a massage business to obtain a business license. And then further down, it says nothing prevents a city from, line 15.13, requiring a criminal background check. So I'm just a little confused by the wording here, because on the one hand, it sounds like it's totally preemptive of city licensing authority, but on the other hand, it says that cities can require a business license or a criminal background check. So I'm just wondering.
Yep. Madam Chair.
Yep, Representative Zerwas, to that point, yep. And then we'll get our last testifier in and get more into the meat of the bill. Cool. Representative Zerwas.
All right, so two things that we have to understand. In one spot, we're talking about business licensures. Nothing in this bill, a voluntary register for individuals to prove they have the education, can pass a criminal background check, have the hours in, and get registered as an individual practicer. They do that at the state level. Nothing in this bill limits a city from saying, hey, if you want to open a massage parlor, here's our regulations for the operation of your business. So there's a business licensure component, and then there's the individual component. This bill deals with the individual component. So that's the clarification there. And then on 15.13, nothing in this bill can be construed from requiring limited municipality from 15.13. Number three, requiring a criminal background check of any unregistered massage and bodywork therapist applying for license to conduct massage and bodywork therapy in the municipality. So if you're registered and you've gone through the state, you're golden. Massage away. If you're unregistered, this bill in no way limits the city's current code of saying, hey, you don't want to register with the state, but you still want to give massages in Elk River, great. Apply for our massage license.
Okay, thank you, Representative Zerwas. We will go to our last testifier and then continue on with questions. And yes, we will bring you forward. Mr. McGrath, welcome to the committee. If you could introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Madam Chairman, members, my name is Lee McGrath. I'm the legislative counsel for the Institute for Justice. We're the leading public interest law firm in the nation, litigating and lobbying against irrational barriers to entry. Madam Chair, Members, you don't need to be a weatherman to determine which way the wind is blowing. With all due respect to Representative Zerwas, this bill sets the stage to convert to an occupational licensing bill. And you can see that by the fact that it is 16 pages long. If it were a registration bill, you would not need 16 pages. Secondly, it has a grandfathering clause. If you were concerned about consumers, you would not have a grandfathering clause. But most powerfully, Madam Chair, there are no consumer advocates here. This bill suffers from all the problems that occupational licensing laws suffer from. That is, that it shrinks the available supply of labor so as to benefit those who are grandfathered in and who are licensees. They get to charge 15% more for their services. In Minnesota, licensing costs 15,000 jobs. The higher prices caused by it exceed $3 billion a year. Licensing, Madam Chair, is very different from unions. Unions tend to shrink the difference between high wagers and low wagers, wage earners. Licensing exacerbates the income inequality, and it benefits those who have access to education, who can charge higher prices, who can exclude competitors. Most importantly, Madam Chair, is that there is not one study that shows that occupational licensing effectively weeds out incompetence and fraud. What weeds out incompetence and fraud are the managers at the Mayo Clinic who look at credentials before they hire a massage therapist. They are the employers at other businesses who look at credentials and experience. Experience. You are having a debate, Madam Chair, about teacher licensing. And the head of the School Board Association testified in the Senate the other day saying that there is no correlation between the requirements to be a teacher and to be of an effective teacher. That is true universally with occupational licensing. These types of bills are intended to reward those with political connections, raise prices, lower opportunities, and most powerfully, lower opportunities for those who do not have access to education or are making mid-career changes. I would encourage you to vote this bill down and let cities regulate your real concern, which is prostitution and human trafficking. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. McGrath. Representative Zerwas, and then we'll go to questions. Representative Zerwas, to your bill.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair, members, and Mr. McGrath, thanks for the wind comment. That was friendly. I think the fact that the bill is 16 pages in length might be less about fence building and more about lawyers chewing on this for a decade. Yes, anyway. You know, we've heard a lot about saying that this is a regulation bill and a fence-building bill. Members, I think this is the exact opposite. Right now, if you want to practice in Minnesota or you want to own a couple businesses in Minnesota and bring in practitioners, if you're a massage therapist in the metro, you have to think, well, if I go here, here's my 15 regulations and my fee I have to pay to practice over there. But if I cross the river and go two blocks into St. Paul, well then, here's my 17 regulations and my fee I have to pay and another background I have to submit for. And if I go to Apple Valley, then I have to do that. And if I go to Burnsville, we're talking dozens and dozens and dozens of incongruent, not in line, non-transferable requirements. Sure, we might be talking about a statewide system, but these are little fences throughout the entire metro area. That's what this bill is about. It's about leveling the playing field. So it says, if you're good enough to do a massage in Burnsville, I think we can trust you to do a massage in Bloomington. If you can do a massage in Maple Grove at Massage Envy, and your boss wants you to cover a shift at Rogers, yeah, you can do that too. That's what this bill is about. And as far as that, this is creating a slippery slope to licensure, folks, they've been at this a decade. A decade. Any other move towards licensure has to be another bill, has to be brought back to this legislature, has to go through the process. Well, I'll be out of here by then. I mean, maybe not Representative Kahn, but everyone else will be. So I don't think we're talking about a slippery slope. It's like a slope lined with molasses.
Thank you, Representative Zerwas. Question from Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Zerwas and to the testifiers that I've heard on this bill, the quandary that I find myself in is that I hear in a number of instances the word voluntary coming up. And I also hear the issue of registration required at a city level. And as I've looked through this bill, and as I'm familiar with other bills that would require or stipulate kind of a voluntary status, it doesn't, to me, it doesn't illustrate that. And so I asked, while the testimony was going on, Ms. Aves, if she would be willing to expound on how the voluntary or the language that would announce voluntary status within the bill or in her experience, how it has been elaborated or enumerated in other bills. And so I'm wondering, Madam Chair, if Ms. Aves would be able to expand on that.
Ms. Aves.
Madam Chair and members, it's by the absence of a mandate. Generally, in a health professional licensing bill, it lists the activities or functions of a person, say, who's going a registered nurse, and says anyone who is not licensed as a nurse is considered to be practicing without a license. This bill does not have that. It's kind of like the absence of, can't prove a negative. This bill is permissive. It allows people to be registered. It lists what functions, what activities a massage and bodywork therapist can perform within their scope of practice, but it doesn't say no one else except a registered massage and bodywork therapist can perform these functions.
Madam Chair.
Representative Albright.
I have another question for Ms. Aves. Ms. Aves, so in light of that comment then, is the bill weakened by the absence of the narrative about voluntary status, or is it rendered neutral by not having it in consideration of other bills that would provide a narrative for voluntary status in the bill?
Ms. Aves.
Madam Chair and Representative Albright, I believe it would be clearer if there was an actual statement saying this is voluntary rather than just the inference that it is voluntary.
Thank you.
Madam Representative Chair. Albright.
And so to that point, Representative Zerwas, just as a commentary in terms of streamlining or making more explicit the nature of the voluntary status of the bill, I would just encourage before GovOps stop possibly an amendment to that note, just so that we're clear in terms of removing that ambiguity from your bill. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Zerwas.
As the bill moves forward, we will continue to work to improve the bill.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess I see a little bit of a hole in the last description, because not restricting to, we have multiple things that are licensed that overlap in scope, and therefore we have many areas that are licensed that aren't specifically restricted to a doctor and not a nurse practitioner and et cetera. So there are quite a few areas that overlap, so it doesn't alleviate my my concern and the fact that it's a registry, but it states preempt a licensure in regulation. To me, that blends over into the area of licensure. If you're preempting it, then you know, frankly, you're doing more than just having a handy reference registry. I'm curious as to, in 1513, it was already touched upon, requiring a criminal background check is prohibited or preempted, etc., for a registered. Is that information available to be shared by the city so they can review that information? Because, you know, frankly, a city should be able to have a more comprehensive approach to its regulation if you're just having a voluntary for reference registry. The city ought to be able to you know, have standards. And if you're saying they can't do their own, if there's already one been done for the registry, does the city have access to that?
Representative Zerwas.
Madam Chair, members, so if someone is unregistered, the city can do any background check they want. If someone is registered and they've passed, there's a list of the exclusions, and it's all of the general exclusions. I think Ms. Daves maybe can touch on the specific exclusions in the bill, but it's a wide swath, and if there's something that we're missing in there, Representative Quam, that's certainly something that we would be willing to work with. But it's pretty much the catch-all that we use on all of our other health practitioner eligibility language.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just looking for a yes or no that cities would not have access to verify on their own, you know, because years go by, we don't know what other statutes and things that might pop up. And so I'm gathering, since you didn't say yes or no, that cities wouldn't have access for their own protection of their own citizens to that information.
Representative Zerwas.
Madam Chair, Representative Quam, members, they would have access if the criminal background check had been completed and the credentials and the hours and the CPR certification and everything was presented and none of the excluding charges or convictions that would qualify someone from working with any other as any other health professional within their city, then they would, what they would be informed is this person is registered and has passed.
Representative Quam.
Madam Chair, I guess I didn't think it was that complex of being able to answer yes or no if it would be available, but it seems obvious that the intent is not to make it available to the cities, that information, so you're you know, restricting information and saying whatever the state decides is the final word, and you know, you guys at your city can't have further concern for your citizens and locality than the state, which, you know, I think, frankly, you know, I feel better if they actually had access to the materials instead of being, oh, we're the government, don't worry, we've taken care of everything. You know, that combining with the you know, a registry, but there's a lot of talk about preempting licensure and the restrictions. I have concerns that this isn't quite ready for prime time. Plus, it'd be interesting to know the total amount of fees this would funnel in for the initial and the estimated for the annual, because it looks as if each school has to do a renewal besides the initial. So I think that this could utilize maybe some final work before I could support it.
Okay, and thank you. I don't, Representative, if you want to comment on that. But members, I just want to let people know we are going to vote on this bill at 4:30. We have a lot of people here for our final bill of the day. And also, we're treading a fine line, members, in terms of the scope of this committee. We're focused on public health. Both the fees and some of the government operations pieces will be dealt with in future committees. So if we could keep our comments and questions two issues related to the scope of this committee, that would be helpful in moving things along. And we do have a few people on the list, so if we could keep questions brief as we're getting to a vote in about 12 minutes. Representative Franzen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess that does narrow down my questions quite a bit, keeping it to this committee, so lucky all of us. So on sections line 1229 to 1232, so this, I'm hearing that possibly this bill would protect people from prostitutes masquerading as massage therapists, but this is already addressed in Statute 146A. The Office of Unlicensed Complementary and Alternative Health Care has investigated massage therapists from complaints of inappropriate touch and have forbidden them from any practice of any kind under 146A. And citizens are also protected underneath 609.344 and 609.345. And on the OCAP report, there's a report of a woman who had applied for and received massage therapy business license from Minnetonka in 2009 and in 2011 was convicted of prostitution. The police had to go undercover to convict her. Her right to practice a 146A modality was revoked by the OCAP. So none of the investigations were about the incompetent massage therapist, nor were they about injuries. They were about boundaries being crossed. So I'm just wondering why there are so many education requirements in this bill. Why not just require a background check? And what will you do about schools that have closed? Because sometimes schools do close from time to time.
Representative Zerwas.
So glad where that question ended. Madam Chair, members, clearly not one business license, not one city ordinance is going to keep out bad actors. What a statewide registry is designed to do is capture very proactive, leading the field providers that want to take down the barriers to allow them to practice across the bounds and in multiple jurisdictions. That's what this is for. Nothing in this bill, if you haven't previously been caught as a bad actor and you have all the other requirements, nothing in this bill, nothing in any licensure, nothing in any business license is going to prevent a future bad actor from being a future bad actor. That's true in this bill, that's true in every other healthcare bill that we deal with. But what this does, as far as my understanding is, the schools and having the schools renew is if they want, that's to look at their current curriculum and making sure it meets the standards. If you have become a registered massage therapist at a given date in a year and you've renewed in your program at that date and year, the curriculum and everything was appropriate, then if your school goes away, just like for those that graduated from Hamlin Law School and now Hamlin Law School's merging with William Mitchell, the folks that graduated from Hamlin are still attorneys. You know, they still met the minimums that you need to. So if your school goes away, but it was registered and the curriculum was approved at that time, you're still going to be a registered massage therapist as you renew and move forward.
Representative Franzen.
Thanks, Madam Chair. And then Representative Zerwas, Kathleen Berg had stated a question or a comment about is it still voluntary if the cities require the massage therapist register? Is it still voluntary if they are like, well, you can practice in the city, but you do need to register on the state as well as our city?
Representative Zerwas.
In order to practice.
Madam Chair, if a city requires their city ordinance that they register in order for an individual license, I don't think you could, but for a business license to say that you have to have registered, that might be true, but as an individual licensor, I don't think so, because I think the preemption clause would take care of that.
Representative Mazin.
Thank you. As it happens, when I was on the Eagan City Council, I remember discussing when we were going to deal with this issue. And at that point, it was probably more about the dealing with the negative part of massage than we're talking about now. But in the last 20 years, I mean, massage has, that industry has just taken off in so many different ways. And I guess my concern is that there are some organizations that still are opposing this that I think that I have an issue with, you know, why they're opposing it if everything's just voluntary. And so I guess if you could address that a little bit more, that would be helpful.
Madam Chair.
Representative Zerwas.
Just briefly, members, on page 4 under section 5, subdivision 4, I know we had some testimony about people that are providing other types of services, some more homeopath, and I think that's where a lot of the pushback is going. And I think the language is very clear in subdivision 4 that other healthcare providers, that nothing in the sections may be construed to prohibit, restrict the practice of, or require massage and body work therapy registration for, and then list out healthcare providers credentialed by the state that use massage and body work therapy in their scope, natural health procedures, practices, treatments. So I think the language really goes above and beyond to say those practicing currently under 146A that don't want to register, that want to keep their scope of practice and keep doing what they're doing, they're going to be okay. They're going to be allowed to practice just like there are. And I know there are people that are uncomfortable with that. If the committee or if individuals, as we move to the next committee, have even clearer language around how to make people feel better about that, I'd love to sit down and work with you. But our intent is to make sure that anyone that's providing these types of services currently can continue to do that the day after this is enacted.
Representative Mazin.
One follow-up. Most of the supporters have talked about money and the fact that it's easier for them to do it at the statewide rather than going through the cities, and I understand that. But nobody has brought in up anything that what is currently going on, that there are a lot of problems out there. So actually, we're not really solving, this isn't solving any problems at this point, is what I'm taking that to mean. Otherwise, there would be people saying, we need this because there's so many bad actors, as you say, out there. All this is doing is making it easier for certain people that want to practice in a wider scope, providing them a little bit more ease. Am I correct?
Madam Chair.
Representative Zerwas.
Close. So I think with the article that we passed around about from the Star Tribune about Minneapolis organizations and the effect that's had on cutting down on some of the sex trafficking issues, there's many cities within the metro area that have no regulations right now. That's an ongoing concern. This bill can help address a lot of those concerns. I think the other thing is it's not money as much as it is the ease of practice and taking away barriers to allow practitioners that want to practice in multiple locales to be able to serve clients in those areas without jumping through administrative hoops in Eagan, in Burnsville, in Apple Valley, in Minneapolis. And that way, I've met the requirements. I can now serve the people I need to, and not depend on if I cross Cedar Avenue or not.
Representative Dean. Representative Allen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I give Representative Zaras credit for bringing a difficult bill. I mean, these types of bills are difficult. And then wish you luck in getting a bill passed that hasn't, has failed at least 25 times. So,
don't tell me that, Representative Allen.
I think there may be some people taking their names off of the bill after this hearing, but anyway. So you got a ways to go here. I think that it's difficult to stay within the policy, the health, because I didn't see anything in here under chapter that it. Any written review that it meets the requirements of Chapter 214. That seems to be missing. And I think, you know, we talk about harm, and there's a little bit, there's been some talk about that, but there's no county attorneys here, there's no police, there's no consumers testifying as to the type of harm that would meet the requirements of Chapter 214. So when you're talking about multi-jurisdictions, I mean, as an attorney, I love multi-jurisdiction stuff because, you know, if you have to pay a different tax and comply with a different permit, and you need somebody that's going to be able to manage all that. But that's not really our concern. It's not a harm to public health, to consumers, for law enforcement. And so that, to me, that usually is addressed through some kind of federal or through some tax or some sort of, usually, but off the corp, you have corporations here, they can probably negotiate with, you know, Bloomington or somebody to get some, you know, some relief from those permit requirements. But the fencing, the occupational fencing that, you know, you create, even those that voluntarily register, that they can, at some point, they'll be able to charge a premium in that. And that's the part where I had a health interpreter law, and what we're leaving out those that would be disadvantaged by it, and that we need to make sure that we're that they're one of the stakeholders and that they're at the table in addressing that. So the I guess those are all my comments. Thank you.
Representative Zerwas.
Madam Chair, and I think, you know, what I will say is I think we are addressing a real issue, and that's access. And the information that we have here from one of the business owners here, say, one of the business representatives, is that they have 50 positions that, through one of the reasons they believe they can't fill slots, is through this regulation kind of jumbled mess. And I think the number is 200 statewide positions that they're just not able to put providers in the communities to service clients because of kind of the encumbrance of regulation. And so I think our job is, as a state policymaker, is to find a way to meet that high bar of regulation and safety, but allow that to be done at a high level that doesn't directly impact consumers in some cities, which currently it is.
Madam Chair?
Representative Allen.
But then again, that's like, you know, seems appropriate then is going to the jobs committee, because that's a jobs bill, not a Chapter 214 bill.
Madam,
thank you, Representative Zerwas.
And I would liken it to a healthcare access issue. In all reality, we've dealt with bills earlier about how do we get providers into parts of the state that are underserved. And I think one way is, as we saw with a few bills, is tuition reimbursement and educational loan forgiveness. I think another very viable way is to allow some of these burdensome local regulations to be handled at a different level to allow a statewide provider. That's not unlike the healthcare provider compact that allows providers to practice in Minnesota and Wisconsin. It's helping get providers to where there's a need.
Okay, members, a brief question from Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick question. I noticed in Article 2 it prohibits individuals from advertising as licensed. If they have a municipal or city license, then they can't advertise unless they have a license from another state or from Minnesota. The Supreme Court has been affording greater protection under the First Amendment to commercial speech. Do you think that raises any First Amendment issues there?
Slightly outside the scope of this committee, but Representative Zerwas, to that point.
Representative Freiberg, that is something I would love to work with you on as we move to GovOps.
I would enjoy nothing more.
Thank you, Representative Freiberg. And final question, Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And first of all, I do think that we should give this bill the time it deserves and not rush it through. And there's been some really good discussion here. And thank you, Representative Allen, for bringing up Chapter 214, because I also wanted to refer to that. Because, and Mr. McGrath referred to it, although kind of quickly, I think. But, members, I had this handed out to you, Chapter 214, .001 and .002, because this clearly lays out the criteria for regulation of a for new regulation of a profession and some criteria. And I actually I'd kind of like to ask the chair, and I'm going to ask her whether this has been met, because there are very specific requirements here, which we did do last year when we had licensing, required everyone to submit a report that's set out in the statute here. And those contents are set out very specifically. And this says that within 15 days of the introduction of a bill proposing new or expanded regulation of an occupation, the proponents must, shall submit a written report to the chair, et cetera, setting out this information. So this is mandatory. It's a shall. And so that would be my first question. But before we get to that, I just want to say I think that the problems that have been laid out here by some of the testifiers are very real problems. I think this committee is kind of recognizing that this inconsistency of regulation across the state, it is a real problem. But I think that the bill goes way too far and kind of bootstraps that problem to propose a solution that indeed steps on the ability of other people to be recognized for their profession. And while it does, it is voluntary in a sense, it creates really two classes of practitioners. And I think somebody said here, maybe it was Representative Freiberg, why does it have, or maybe, I don't know who said it, but why does it have all these educational requirements in here? That was Representative Franson, thank you. A couple of them that I noticed that I in here are concerning. Why in the world would you have to have a high school diploma to be a massage therapist? And the fact that it's saying that you have to carry a minimum of $1 million of coverage, of professional liability coverage per occurrence. So, I mean, we're going way, way beyond the problem of having inconsistent regulation across the state into a thing that says it's regulation, and it seems to be kind of a hybrid between regulation and licensing. And that's set out in 214, too. There's a kind of what the different levels of regulation are. So registration and licensing, we're creating kind of a hybrid in this bill. And for me, I think it's better than some of what I've seen in the past, but the fact that it's been around for at least 10 years should tell you there's something wrong. Obviously, other legislatures have rejected this scheme. I really think there are other ways that we could be dealing with the very real problems that have been articulated, and they might involve doing some preempting of local ordinances and putting something in place that would allow all municipalities to get a level of control over the potential prostitution issues and all of that without stepping on the toes of lots and lots of good practitioners who are doing things for which they don't want to have to have $1 million of insurance or have to jump through a bunch of educational hoops and pay a lot of fees to be able to have their profession recognized. And I also, like some other members have said, I really haven't heard anything about the safety issues, and that, in fact, is what the statute goes to. So I really think this bill is not ready for prime time. Unfortunately, after 10 years or 25 or however many it's been, Representative Zerwas, I really don't feel it's ready for prime time. I think we should deal with these problems in a different way, and I'd like to ask the chair to please respond about whether the criteria were met. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Liebling, and I'm looking at the handout that you gave us, and I did ask about this very piece with the report that was supposed to be submitted to a chair, and the explanation or understanding that I was given in terms of the explanation of what was required was that because this isn't a mandatory regulation, there's the voluntary piece, that this speaks to kind of an overriding regulatory mechanism that we're putting in place as a legislature, and we're not in fact doing that. We are creating a voluntary registration system. That's the explanation that was given to me when I asked about this very issue, and so I will say I've had, you know, various discussions with the various people have spoken to this bill, but in regards to your question about this report, that was the information that I was given.
Okay, well, thank you, Madam Chair, for that. And I'm glad to know that you did, you know, raise the issue with the proponents of this. And I worked with this group quite a bit in the last session and really went around the block a number of times with them trying to get something that I would thought was workable and never was able to get there with them. But I do think that this applies, and I guess it's the chair's prerogative to decide that you don't think it applies, but I think it's pretty darn clear that this is a bill proposing new or expanded regulation of an occupation, although perhaps not everybody who could possibly say they were doing body work, but it's certainly a regulation of a certain sector of this occupation. And so I think that this statute should be complied with. I think it's here for a reason. Another member was talking about the healthcare access. Representative Zerwas was discussing that. I think that's an entirely different issue, but you know, if we're going to go down the road they want to go down, at the very least, I think they should comply with Minnesota statute. And I would urge members to vote no on the bill today, which is what I intend to do.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. And Representative Zerwas, I'll let you close those comments or close out on your bill briefly, and we'll go to a vote. And I will say, Representative Zerwas, as you move to the next committee, I'll have a conversation with the chair of that committee. Make them aware of this. I do think Representative Liebling brings up some good points. I think there is some leeway because of the nature of this bill, but just encourage you to take a look at that. Representative Zerwas, final word on your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. And I think after 10 years of working on this, or 25 years, good Lord, but I think we can all agree it's been 10. I think the reality is this bill is coming together, and it's been kind of negotiated to, I think someone made the comment of it being 16 pages. We are committed to continuing to work on this bill, and I think Representative Freiberg has brought up a good point, Representative Franson brought up some good points, Representative Quam brought up some good points, and we will continue to work on all of those issues as we move this forward. Members, I think the most important thing is I think this is an access issue. I think this is an issue that allows people, practitioners, the freedom to practice throughout the state and not be hamstrung by kind of these low fences. I think the idea that a voluntary registry that allows you to get out of local regulations, that somehow is fence building. I think that's a backwards view of this. This is allowing flexibility for practitioners and business owners. And in talking with our advocates, I know moving this bill forward, we are committed to continuing to work with all stakeholders to get to a position where we have a bill that people can agree on. And with that, Madam Chair, I'd like to renew my motion.
Thank you, Representative Zerwas. So members, Representative Zerwas will renew his motion that House File 644, as amended, be re-referred to the Government Operations Committee. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
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 The motion prevails. Division being called. Members, I will ask for, if you'll raise your hands, all those in favor of the motion, please raise your hands. Okay, thank you. All those opposed, please raise your hand. Thank you. Members, we have 13 ayes and 8 noes. The motion prevails.
Thank you, members.
Thank you, Representative Zerwas. Members, our last bill for the day is House File 316, Representative Schumacher.
Madam Chair. Madam Chair.
Representative Mulry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I see we're trying to figure out what's going on, and even the advocates don't know what's going on because this is, we thought it was coming up, and we're in favor of this bill, maybe with some changes, but very much want to do it, and it's an informational hearing, and we don't know what's happened, why it's an informational hearing. The advocates don't, that we've talked to. And so what is the intention on this? We want to make sure that we have plenty of time to discuss it and make it as good as we can. But what is happening?
thank you, Representative Mulry. Just one moment. Representative Mulry, I'm going to get a little bit of clarification. My understanding, and I don't know if Representative Schumacher can speak to this, my understanding is we wanted to get the informational hearing done on this with the plans to move the bill, hopefully in short order in the next couple of days, but there may have been a couple of small changes that would need to be made that would bounce it back to our committee, and in the interest of trying to do this in an expedient and logical fashion, getting the information out today, the questions asked, and things like that. And if there's a few issues that need to change, we will get those changed, move it out of the committee, and move it along in the process, because our intention is to get this bill moving as well.
Well, Madam Chair, that doesn't work very well. How do we know when, in other words, when is it going to come up where we can actually, like, have amendments, whatever, really flush it out, and those that would come with amendments, and if there's changes, I'm very much in favor of the bill. I'm very much not in favor of expediency at all on this bill, because it's a very important bill. So if the intent is to expedience after today, I'm very opposed to it. If the intent is to really have a thorough discussion, possible amendments from each side, that we look good and have a really good bill coming out of here, then, and spend plenty of time, then I'm really for that. So it worries me when you say we're going to do something today really quick and then expedient get out of here. That isn't what I think is needed on this really important bill. For this is one of the big bills for the session. So
thank you, Representative Mulry. And I guess just to be clear, I don't intend to, when I say expediency, I didn't mean in terms of rushing it through. I meant understanding that this is an enormous reform, and us being the reform committee, and it's groundbreaking, and it would be pretty pivotal moving forward. And so my intention was to get a really good lay of the land today from the advocates, a time to ask questions in terms of what's in front of us, and then take it up again, at which point if there are amendments needed. I think that it's clear in reading this bill and even understanding rate methodology, it can be a very confusing topic. for members can be extremely complicated, and so I think this bill does lend itself to requiring quite a bit of time, and I think getting a good understanding today would better educate members on if there are amendments or things that they want to see different in the future.
Madam Chair,
Representative Mulry.
No problem with going ahead and starting to, and just even explaining the the whole, it's not just rebasing, it's the formulas, all kinds of things, and I think they've been changed every year since 2003 or something, and every year it's the final change going to happen, and then the very following year it changes. So I agree that it needs a lot of things. I just want to make sure we have plenty of time to, because it sounds like both sides might have amendments as we look at this more, and we want to be just really thorough on this before it goes out of here. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Mulry. To your bill, Representative Schumacher.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. House File 316 is a bill I am proud to carry because it brings not only the state reimbursement back to the cost of actual care in the state for our nursing home care facilities, but also because it reforms the way that we cover the cost of care for our seniors. As lawmakers, we need to ensure that Minnesota is a great place to live and raise a family and start a business, but we also need to ensure that we as a state support aging Minnesotans and that our seniors can get the quality care that they need as they grow older. Approximately 60,000 Minnesotans will turn 65 this year, and each year thereafter for the next 20 years. In just a few short years, there will be more seniors living in Minnesota than school children, and that rate of growth will demand that we rethink and reform how we provide care within our communities. House File 316 is a step in the right direction as it realigns our payment system with the actual cost of care, rewards efficiencies and quality improvement systems, and will improve the ways, wages, and benefits of our caregivers. Here with me today are representatives from the Long-Term Care Imperative to explain more details of the bill.
Mr. Pearson, welcome to the committee. If you could introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good afternoon, members of the committee. My name is Toby Pearson from Care Providers of Minnesota. Today with me is Carrie Thurlow from Leading Age Minnesota. Together, our organizations are the collaboration here at the Capitol known affectionately as the Long-Term Care Imperative. We are pleased to testify today in support of House File 316 and thank Representative Schumacher for bringing this bill forward. Minnesota, we have a lot to be proud of. We have a tradition of providing good care to our seniors, high quality care. We lead the country with respect to our senior care system. We've been ranked number one in a lot of different ways as we care for seniors. While this is a great starting point, the challenge we have before us is that we are not prepared for the future. As Representative Schumacher stated, there will be 60,000 new seniors each year. They will and are living longer. In just 5 short years, there will be more seniors than school children. And this growth in seniors is driving greater demand in all of senior services. In short, we bring this bill forward in hopes that we can reform and transform the way we pay for senior services in Minnesota.
Ms. Thurlow, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Carrie Thurlow with Leading Age Minnesota, and here on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative. I, too, want to join Mr. Pearson in thanking Representative Schumacher for bringing forward House File 316. It is a bill that will reform our system of paying for senior care services so that we can be better prepared to meet the growing demands of senior care as our population ages. This bill reflects a long journey, a collaborative effort, and a lot of dialogue where we first identified some shared values, including paying caregivers an honorable wage, supporting innovation and quality, and ensuring that seniors have access to the care that they need in their communities. And that this bill will build a system that supports these values. Later this afternoon, you will hear from some of our members about the potential impact of this bill. And you'll also hear from colleagues of ours regarding the details of the bill. But before we get to that, we do want to leave you with, introduce you to the second video. Some of you may have heard of the Face Aging campaign. Some of you have already met Helen. And today we want to introduce you to Beatrice, who is another one of the 840,000 seniors living in Minnesota. Beatrice is a lifelong Minnesotan who now thrives as she lives in a senior living community. Madam Chair, this is just a little brief introduction to Beatrice and the Face Aging Campaign.
My husband never got to go to high school. He was the older boy in the family, and you probably understand the older boy stayed home and helped the dad at home. And he always said to me, I'm never going to do that to my boys. If they don't want to farm, they're not going to farm. We had an auction in 2 weeks, sold the cattle, and he went to work for the city. My husband and I farmed there from 1951 until 1964. So then at that very time, I was called back to 3M down at Cottage Grove. And I went there for 2 weeks, and I stayed 21 years. I was going to go home, and the head of human resources called me, and he said, we don't want you to go home. We want you here. Well, I was very active at the church, very active. I was on every committee. I took care of all the funerals for years and years. And it's just now that my legs got bad that I haven't been able to do that. And I love my church, and I still do. I mean, it was very important to my family and to me. I was not feeling well, and my doctor said, you've got to come into the hospital and find out what's wrong. And before I got even into a bed, the doctor came out, and he said, well, we know what's wrong with you. Your blood sugar is 489. So that's why I'm here. I have my family to be thankful for. They're very important to me. Especially when you've been alone without a husband for so long. I get lots of praise from my kids. They come and they say, Mom, you're so much stronger. You're doing so well, and that kind of thing. And I think that boosts me up, too. Yeah. I'm getting old. Aren't we all?
Welcome to the committee. If you want to introduce yourselves and proceed with your testimony.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Good afternoon, to Madam Chair and to the members of the committee. My name is Craig Kittleson, and I'm the CFO for Augustana Care. I also serve on the board of directors of Leading Age Minnesota. Augustana Care is a not-for-profit organization that was established in 1896 to provide services to older adults and others in need through the provision of health care, housing, and other services. We operate in several communities across the state, including Apple Valley, Hopkins, Dassel, Minnetonka, Minneapolis, Burnsville, and Moose Lake. So we're spread out all over the state. Each year we serve over 15,000 seniors throughout the state of Minnesota and touch the lives of 3,000 people on a daily basis. We also have approximately 2,500 dedicated employees. I want to thank you, Representative Schumacher, for bringing forward House File 316 in an effort to reform our senior care payment system. But in fact, reform is not the most appropriate term, and that reform implies that there's a system to be fixed. Sadly, there isn't a payment system in Minnesota today, and there hasn't been for a long time. There isn't a day that goes by that the shortcomings of not having a payment system are not made manifest. It is difficult to describe how badly the proposed legislation is needed in a few minutes. I'll do my best to paint for you a brief picture of our situation. At Augustana, we are the stewards of many things, but the two most important are the people that look to us for their well-being and also our underappreciated caregivers who are the cornerstone of our organization. It's very easy to lose sight of mission or the care these people provide when not witnessed in person. Residents and employees can become just faceless numbers, which is unfortunate. But I want you to know that our employees are amazing people who see, hear, touch, and comfort older adults who need their care every single day. We
Without these caregivers, we would not have a mission. And over the years, without a rational payment system, it has become increasingly difficult to recruit and retain caregivers in each of our care settings. I spoke to some of Augustana's human resource people before coming today, and this isn't news, but confirmed that Augustana is losing employees for better wages to hospitals, where it's not unusual for a nurse to receive $10 or more an hour increase over what they're able to pay in a care center, and nursing assistants $5 or more an hour. But in addition to this loss, with the strong economic recovery, we are experiencing more and more employees leaving healthcare altogether and going to non-healthcare related jobs. As you're probably aware, skilled care center rates have been effectively frozen for 8 of the last 12 years. In the other years, there were modest COLAs, or cost of living increases, that were largely encumbered to wages, but little or nothing for other operating costs. Of course, we're very grateful to for the legislation that passed 2 years ago that allowed us to provide an increase to wages to our employees via 3.25 cost of living adjustment, and then added any kind of incentive for quality add-on dollars that we had. However, I'd like to put those increases into perspective for you. Today, I brought some of the worksheets that Augustana sent to the Department of Human Services in order to provide support for the increase in rates that went into effect on September 1 of 2013. One of the worksheets shows that of the dollars received from the state, Augustana not only spent 100% of those, but an additional 51%. At another facility, we spent nearly double the dollars received, spending 175% of the monies allocated, and in another case, 156%. The amounts received as the rate increase were spent on employee salaries, fringe benefits, and especially health insurance costs, which had increased 22% just that current year. In addition, increases for other costs of operations such as food, utilities, and supply, which I know sometimes aren't as glamorous as direct care dollars, have not had a rate increase in years. And as a result of all these factors, we have seen the financial foundation of our senior facilities erode to the point where many facilities are just hanging on. A non-existent payment system does not make for continuity of quality care. House File 316 would go a long way in dealing with a lot of these issues through the filing of a cost report that in turn would not only provide information to pay for actual costs of service, but would also incentivize providers to strive for greater quality and quality improvements. Another benefit to enacting House File 316 is that it would at long last bring some predictability to skilled care facility payment streams. I don't know if any of you have your own businesses, but even if you don't, I'm sure you realize the benefit of planning for the future. That's what we're doing here today. Given the non-current system of payment, skilled care facilities have been in a reactive mode for years. Our strategic plan often consists of trying to figure out what we'll do in the next 6 to 12 months because we simply do not know what we will be paid the next year. Providers and employees have given their all for a very worthy cause, caring for our seniors, and have done pretty well given the constraints that we have. But just imagine the possibilities if we could pay people a competitive wage, and rather than constantly worrying about meeting payroll or finding adequate staff or worrying about other escalating costs, our energies could be focused on taking better care of those who need it. We need to think big, not small. Madam Chair, I want to thank you and all those on this committee for taking up the challenge of solving a critical problem that has long gone without address. But I also want to close by taking the time to honor the caregivers in our settings, as well as those throughout the state of Minnesota. The simple fact is that these people do not receive pay commensurate with what they deserve for their service. Whether the caregiver is a CNA, an LPN, an RN, or they work in the dietary, housekeeping, laundry, or maintenance department, all of these people are doing good and noble work. This may be the most important bill debated this session as we continue to see the march of our society aging. And I would ask you and urge you to support House File 316 as a step in the right direction in setting our priorities for the future. Thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you so much, Mr. Kittleson. Thank you for being in the committee today. If you can introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. I'm Tom Pollock. I am the administrator of Park River Estates Care Center and the chair of the board for care providers in Minnesota. I speak in support of House File 316. Park River Estates Care Center is family-owned and it's operated since 1966. We are a 99-bed skilled facility. Each year we serve over 200 seniors. My organization struggles with recruitment as well, but I want to take a moment just to describe the challenges we face in retaining great caregivers once we are successful at recruiting them. Senior care settings are often the training grounds for new nurses. Recent data shows that senior care providers throughout Minnesota hire the vast majority of new graduates from nursing programs. But within 18 months, most of the nurses have left the long-term care settings and have gone to more lucrative hospital jobs. The Long-Term Care Imperative estimates that a hospital RN makes nearly $35,000 more a year than an RN in a senior care setting. And a nursing assistant makes more than $12,000 a year than a nursing assistant in the hospital, than a nursing assistant in the long-term care setting. For my organization, that means constant turnover. In 2014, we had 20 nursing assistants and 6 RNs leave, and they actually told us they were leaving because they could make more money elsewhere. Our turnover is about 50%, which translates to over $110,000. While the numbers are startling, the biggest impact is on the people who we are trying to serve. Constant turnover means that the staff really don't know our residents. It's those special little details that make care extraordinary. I urge you to make reforming our reimbursement system a priority this session so that we can provide the quality care that thousands of Minnesota seniors deserve. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you so much for being here.
You're very welcome.
Other folks who want to testify? Welcome to the committee. If you could introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Jeff Bostick with Leading Age Minnesota. I'm here with Todd Bergstrom of Care Providers of Minnesota, where we work with Carrie Thurlow and Toby Pearson as part of the Long-Term Care Imperative, and we're primarily here to answer any questions that people may have about the details of the legislation, which we've been working with for the last several months.
Thank you so much for being here. Members, I don't see that we have any other testifiers at this point, so we can move to questions. And actually, we have this handout here that kind of walks us through the components of the bill. And so maybe if you want to just walk us through that briefly, might preempt some questions, and it might, you know, spur on others, but it would probably be helpful for the committee as some of this stuff gets pretty technical.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee, Representative Schumacher. So I'm going to start off, and then I'll turn it over to Jeff. So, yes, the document you have in front of you is our current issue paper trying to explain House File 316. And so I'll just give a little background. So beginning last spring, Jeff Bostick and I began meeting with Department of Human Services staff trying to outline what we thought a new system could be and how we could address the many issues. And so just for background, we spent essentially the first couple of months working up to those 5 goals you see on the first page. And I think it's really important as we work through the details that the details are meant to reinforce and support those goals. So preserving access to the continuum of care, invest in recruitment and retention of caregivers, reward quality care. Jeff will go into that, but that is an underlying very important reform element of this proposal. Preserve dignity and quality of life regardless of how and where services are delivered. And then finally, develop a system that actually funds what the cost of care is for caring for seniors in Minnesota. And so if you turn to just real quickly to page 3 of this document, at the bottom you see a chart. And what stands out about Minnesota for the last 20 years is we've actually
it seems difficult to understand, but we've operated without a system. We have a lot of statute. We have a lot of things that say this and that. But when it's all said and done, if you look what other states do, we have not had a system that other states have adopted, meaning we've not utilized cost report data. We've not created annually kind of rates that reflect the cost of care, whether it be cost-based or, in the case of our bill, cost-based with some price efficiencies. So turning back to page one, you can see our proposal begins October 1st, 2015 with full implementation, utilizing the cost reports that were submitted by facilities to the Department of Human Services, in addition to a number of quality metrics that have been developed by the Department of Human Services from the 2014 year. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Bostic.
Thank you. So just to pick up basically with page two, and I'm not going to go into a great level of detail here, but if people want to, certainly we can. Page two kind of lays out the components of the rate. These are components that are part of nursing home. I've been a part of nursing home rates for a long time. What we're basically do is going back to the beginning and trying to figure out how would we redetermine these rates based on current conditions, based on using quality as one of the factors here. We do start on the nursing home side with a significant amount of infrastructure we can work from. Facilities do file cost reports annually already. That's a requirement. There are quality measures collected by the Department of Human Services that result in an overall quality score that can be used to adjust payment. So in our conversations, we looked at on the care-related side, for example, that portion of the rate, which is primarily the caregiving that's provided to people directly, looked at paying for the actual cost of providing that care in each facility, but then limiting it to instill some amount of an efficiency incentive that beyond a certain level the state shouldn't pay rates that go to excessively high costs. And in addition, then, providing an incentive to, you can get a higher limit if you have a higher quality score, so that over time people who want to make an investment in caregiving can get an incentive to get a higher limit and thus a higher rate. Another operating, we took a slightly different approach. This is basically dietary, housekeeping, laundry, utilities, where it is going to be based on costs, but it's costs across a group of facilities, so everyone gets paid the same price. Todd made reference to using price as one of the components there. But overall, I want to make the point that this entire system that we've structured is intended to reward quality, pay for the actual cost of providing care, and have a system that continues to do that ongoing into the future. I want to jump then to the final page, and some of what's on the final page, page four, is financial information, which is probably more suited for a discussion with the Finance Committee, but we do have some information about initial projections of how facilities statewide would be affected by this bill. There is a fiscal note that if you want to look up online that explains the overall cost of the bill. And there is a component in the bill that would increase the elderly waiver and alternative care caps in conjunction with the adjustments to the nursing home rates. Those are programs that provide services to people in the community that are similar to the types of services that you would receive in a nursing home. And we want those there to remain a certain amount of parity between those two programs, or a connection between those two programs, so this is not an incentive to use a nursing home for someone who's more suited to being served successfully in the community. So that's an important piece of this overall initiative as well.
Okay, thank you very much. Members, any questions? Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, got all kinds of questions that I haven't even thought of yet. how do you say quality is a factor, and I assume when you're saying that, you're not talking about the different care levels of the patients. So how do you rate quality on nursing homes?
Okay. Mr. Bergstrom.
Yep. Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative. So I'd say the last 12 years or so, the Minnesota Department of Human Services has developed a number of quality measures and validated them. And so for this proposal, we're selecting kind of three groups of measures. The first is the one you're probably most familiar with, and that is the health department surveys. Certain
deficiencies have been selected out of that, and if you don't get those deficiencies, then you get maximum points. The second area is every year the Department of Human Services contracts with Vital Research, which is a survey company, to do in-person customer satisfaction surveys with every nursing home in the state. And that represents 40% of the quality score. The remaining 50% is based on the minimum data set QI. So every quarter, an admission, a nursing facility resident is assessed by a federally mandated assessment. And from that, a number of quality indicators have been validated federally and by the state of Minnesota to judge kind of how quality of the residents is being addressed. So within that bucket, there's, I think, about 25 quality indicators that are aggregated to composite a score up to 50 points. So when it's all said and done, you add it up to, it adds up to 100 points, and that score that a facility would have is then used to create the limit that Jeff referenced for care-related rates.
So,
Representative Mulry.
I'm sorry, I didn't follow how the federal quality rater comes in once a year and
the okay.
Mr.
So there's
Bergstrom.
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative. There's two components. There's an annual customer satisfaction survey that the state of Minnesota contracts, and once a year, those folks are out in the field doing in-person surveys. Mm-hmm. The other one is actually there's a for Medicare and Medicaid and private pay. There's a federally mandated assessment system that occurs in Minnesota for Medicaid and private pay quarterly, where a person's needs are assessed. And within our rate structure, that person's rate is assigned based on their needs. That document also has a lot of information that can be used and has been used to develop kind of measures that you're allowed to use to measure how a facility is performing. So use of antipsychotics, pressure ulcers. There's I think 25 or so that we currently use. And I also note all these are also used, all three of these, for the state of Minnesota's nursing home report card. So that's where they're also being utilized currently.
Okay, so the
Representative Mulry.
Not having been involved with this, the first part of the last one is like the old A through K system then for rating?
Yes. Yes.
And then there's a added on in that last 50% thing is a progress or also a what types of treatment they're getting?
I think perhaps the best way to describe it is that the assessment that's required is kind of serving a dual purpose. It's measuring the person's needs, which is being used to set the equivalent
that's
of an A through K payment.
System we've always had forever.
And then that information is also being used to measure, for example, your rate of patients who have pressure sores and whether those pressure sores are improving. I mean, this is a highly simplified description of it, but you know, they basically aggregate this information for each facility for all their residents and are able to assign a score essentially to how well you're performing on 25 or so measures of quality of care.
In the
Representative Mulry.
Chair, totally different type of line of you've talked a lot about the need for incentivizing employees so that there's good quality employees. And I see that we're basing some things on that. But I just glancing through it fairly quickly, where does it guarantee that these increases go down to the employees?
Mr. Bostic, or
Madam Chair, Representative. So that kind of the backbone of this entire system is the nursing facility cost report. And so we begin the whole process in judging rates based on what the actual cost experience was of a facility. So if they're not spending the money, or if they don't have cost reflective of it, it can't be reflected in their rates.
Okay.
And 70% of those costs, I think, in rough terms, are employee wages and benefits today. It's a very labor-intensive industry, so your higher-cost facilities are going to be facilities that are spending more on labor.
And
Representative Mulry.
For somebody that doesn't understand this, What is the difference between price-based and cost-based? It seems like the cost to me to do something is the same as the price to me to do something, but could you explain that?
Madam Chair, Representative.
Mr. Bergstrom.
Yes. The easiest way to think of it is for cost-based, that reflects your actual cost as a facility with this incentive that we've built in for quality. Price means the state is establishing a price for a set of services and applying it to everyone in a peer group, saying for this set of services, the payment is going to be the same regardless of what facility you are. That would be the primary difference.
Okay, thank you. I understand that. Okay, thank you.
Representative Mulry.
That's it.
Okay.
For right now.
Other questions, members? Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm looking at the statewide graph in the maroon and gold, and I'm not quite understanding in terms of, and hoping you can provide some clarity in terms of the peer groups that have been organized around here. In the definition, it says it's based upon the current wage data, but it seems a bit at odds with that statement if you compare, I believe it's the county where Moorhead is located, as compared to the counties in the Arrowhead region. It seems like you're at odds with your own statement.
Mr. Bostic.
Thanks for the question, and thanks, Madam Chair. The group was developed, the groups were developed based on the actual wage data within nursing homes for the three primary nursing positions. So we looked at that information from the cost report that we've mentioned. And then it's not, you know, it's not 100% scientific because not every county has, you know, the same number of facilities. Some of them are relatively small. You have to kind of look at their neighbors, make some judgments. But in general, you know, we found that the average costs were, you know, about 10% higher in what have been labeled as the maroon counties as opposed to the gold counties. And what we're trying to do by using the two peer groups is to, we talked about what the limit on costs being one of the features that encourages efficiency. We want to pay for costs and we want to encourage investments in costs, but up to a certain limit because the state is not going to pay an unlimited rate to every facility. But we wanted the limits to reflect the actually what it costs them within their labor market to hire staff, because we know that it's different within different parts of the state. So that was the reason for going through the process and assigning the groups that way. And I would also point out that within our analysis right now, most facilities will get paid on care-related, what in the, at least in the first year of implementation, what their costs for care-related are. Only a little more than 10% of the facilities would be subject to a reduction because of that limitation on costs.
Madam Chair.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so to that point then, as I'm looking at the bottom end of the state, just kind of drawing an imaginary line for I-90 as it goes across the state, you've got Winona to the far east, and then you're coming across and you've got Austin, you've got Albert Lea, Blue Earth, Fairmont, Jackson, whatnot. It would seem to me that we're creating a disparity based upon geographic dispersion from the midpoint being Mankato or around Blue Earth County. Why would, and to that extent, if you're in Faribault County, is that a better grouping than being in Blue Earth County?
Mr. Bostic.
Thanks. The limit, based on the data we are using from the 2013 cost report, which this will be updated over time, the limit on care-related would be about 10% higher in the Maroon County versus the Gold County. Wherever you are in the state, I would point out that the gold counties do, most facilities in that area are not over their limit today, so they would be paid their full cost and they would have the opportunity to have increases in the future based on increases in cost. So, you know, the question of whether it's a disadvantage, we, you know, did not in any way attempt to set up a system that would be disadvantageous to any facility in any county. And we certainly, we even put in some language in the bill, if you look at that. That would review the counties on a regular basis so that they could be reassigned to other counties if their pattern of spending has and their labor cost pattern has changed over time. So we don't necessarily view this map as kind of set in stone as a permanent feature of the system the way it appears today.
Representative Albright.
Well, yeah, and this is more of an op-ed statement then. So if you take a look at, you know, Cottonwood County, for example, or Murray County, you obviously have disparities between care centers within the county themselves. So if this is a county wage data aggregation, then aren't you setting up one to be pitted against the other in terms of for their payment schedule between care centers within the county?
Mr.
One could be more profitable than another or have excessive costs based upon mismanagement, but how are you dealing with that dilemma on a countywide basis?
Mr. Bostic.
We're trying to create a system where every facility will be paid on the basis of what their actual costs are up to a limit, so they will have to look at what their practices are now, what their competitors' practices are, how close they are to that limit, whether they're over the limit and need to cut back. So there will be a lot of decisions that go into this, but we think that the incentives that everyone's facing are the right ones to invest in the right way, try and improve quality, and try to keep costs under a limit so as to be, you know, as efficient as you can.
Mr. Bergstrom.
Madam Chair, Representative, the one other thing I would point out is the biggest difference for facilities within a county will be the ones with better quality will have a better limit. I mean, that ultimately will be the distinguishing factor as we proceed in beyond implementation into actual year-to-year rate setting.
Representative Albright. Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Because I don't serve on the other committee, this is the first chance I've had a chance to have you walk through it. So I have a number of questions, but, you know, and most of it focuses on the nursing home facilities, but I do hope we can get to some questions about its impact on our community service delivery system. But as I look at this, there's no phase in. We would implement this with a hold harmless so that nobody loses anything. Is that correct?
Yeah. Representative Schumacher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Loeffler, yes.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you. When I look at the table that's been handed out, and I'm hoping we can get it broken down to even more detail of what is the number of beds per facility in each of these categories. We have the number of facilities with the percent revenue increase. If we could get the number of beds in each and the public versus private pay, and I bet you even have a list of facilities. That would be really nice for us to know how our facilities and our districts would be faring. One of my concerns is, on a bipartisan basis, there has always been strong support for the rate equalization that has been a long-term Minnesota tradition. And what that means is that, you know, if you're paying privately out of the money that you save by, you know, putting aside resources or buying insurance or whatever, that you pay the same as the person who's in the bed next to you or the room next to you who happens to be relying on public paid. And we don't discriminate based on those life circumstances. But that does mean that if we're going to, on average, increase rates 25%, that those individuals who worked hard, who saved, who are paying, you know, out of their life's work savings, they're going to face increases of, on average, 25%, but those in 29 facilities will see increases of 40% or greater. And I cringe to imagine what we're going to hear when we hear from those people who see those kind of increases. So can you tell me, Representative Schumacher, how you envision that going forward?
Representative Schumacher.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Loeffler. That is one of the concerns I have as well with this. And with talking to the department, that's it's not so much the rate equalization, it's some of the federal Medicaid reimbursement for what they have there. So the federal government says that they'll reimburse for Medicaid up to what we're charging. And if we're charging private pay people less than what we're charging our Medicaid rates are going to pay the lesser rate. And so it's kind of a double-edged sword here with what we have for this. On the other hand, with rate equalization and facilities wanting to charge more to someone who's private pay versus this bill makes that, so that's really not an issue because they're going to be paying for the cost of care. For people who are private pay today, they are basically, they're not paying for the cost of care today either, just like the state isn't paying for the cost of care. They're not paying for about $35 for their bed each day in there, just like the Medicaid reimbursement is. And so this brings it up to the cost of care. So really they would be, those people who did save and did their work, which we want more people to do, would be paying simply for their cost of care.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and Rep. Schumacher. I appreciate you recognizing that as a major hurdle. And, you know, there isn't a provider in Minnesota, I don't think, in MA, no matter whether they're dentists or nurses or doctors or anything, whoever testifies that they get their costs covered. And somehow they all stay in business. So I'm just always kind of amazed by that, particularly in this business when it's totally regulated on the costs. And so somehow something works, and I don't think it's all just private fundraising. But that's maybe a discussion for the other day. The other thing that looked to me like a really major policy choice that we're going to have to wrestle with is that you really create now two different systems at very unequal financial status in our home and community-based services for people who are on waivers, whether they're on, because this would say that if you're delivering home care, medication management, helping grandma take a bath, you know, helping someone who's paralyzed transfer and get dressed in the morning and out and about, that if you're working with someone who's over 65, you're going to get a lot of money. And if you're working for someone who's developmentally disabled or mentally ill or paraplegic or has MS or has some other thing and is getting the exact same services, they're going to get dramatically less. And I think it's going to be really hard for the providers of home and community-based services, for people who have MS, who have paralysis, who have traumatic brain injuries or whatever, to compete to find workers if there's going to be this breakup in our home and community-based waiver system. And have you worked with that and figured out how we're going to deal with that yet?
Mr. Bergstrom.
Madam Chair, Representative, so just to just make it really clear what we're proposing to do. Prior to 2011, elderly waiver and its caps were linked to increases on nursing facility funding. And that was delinked in 2011. And why we bring this forward is twofold. First of all, we're a little bit afraid that we're going to start seeing this parity erode where the incentive will be to put someone in a nursing home rather than utilize elderly waiver, community-based services, assisted living. So we're proposing to relink them. The other thing that this does is this: all this does is raises the cap. And so what it's intended to do is if somebody who is a case mix B on elderly waiver needs more services, they'll have more room to have services assigned. So that's the intention of what this will do. And I'll just note that elderly waiver, and I could be misspeaking, is I believe the only waiver program that has a cap. And so we want to develop a way that will allow that cap to kind of achieve that parity with nursing facility services.
And I'm not going to take the whole committee's time, but I do think that's something that we really have to wrestle with because we've gone to uniform assessments. The Department of Human Services has been working hard on that, and so that we treat people with the same needs, the same, whether their disabling condition happens to deal with age or it happens to deal with an accident or it happens to deal with an MS diagnosis at a younger age. And I think this is a major, major issue. The other thing that looked to me like a change potentially in policy is on how you're handling health insurance. And in the past, in law, we consider health insurance a benefit. And now you've pulled that out as a totally separate section on lines 4.1 to 4.8 and define it in some ways that I think are really not necessarily in the best interests of many of your employees. First of all, you say that it shall only be allowable if they are employees who meet the definition of full-time employees under the federal Affordable Care Act. This is an industry that is notoriously dependent on part-time workers, and that's appropriate for the types of work that they do and the demand for the types of services, whether it's your food service people, whether it's your cleaning people, whether it's someone who's coming in to provide therapy for a part of a day. And this would say that we're only going to, that we actually create an incentive to only offer health insurance for full-time employees. And I don't think that's a Minnesota value, and I think we need to think about that. But then it also goes further to say on lines 4.5 to 4.6 that it deals with employer contributions to employee health reimbursement and savings accounts. And you only need health reimbursement and health savings accounts if you're using high deductible policies. And high deductible policies in an industry with rapid turnover employees, with low wage employees, are not appropriate for the majority of workers. And so I do think that this you're asking us to propose major increases in an industry that I don't doubt deserves significant investment. But you're asking us to do it in a way that authorizes in law perhaps greater mistreatment of employees and incenting and walking away from those part-time workers, those people who turn over, so who they won't have the benefit. And so I really do think this is a major change, and I think we need to look back, going back to the previous definition of fringe benefits as including health costs, and we should actually incent the additional increases that are an average 25%, could be as high as 40% or higher, that those make sure that we're making sure that our employees are treated fairly. The injuries in this industry are really high, and the health risk exposures are high. And if ever there was an industry before this committee that deserves solid, affordable health insurance, whether you're the lowest paid person with the 8 weeks training to be a nursing assistant, or you're someone at an RN level, I think you deserve to have legitimate health care that covers your first dollar or close to that. And so maybe you'd want to comment on why you felt like there was a need for a totally different set of statutes on health insurance.
Mr. Bostic.
Thanks for the question, Representative Lofner. Thanks, Madam Chair. There were quite a few questions there, so let me try and see if I can and hit on all of them. First of all, the reason that health insurance is being moved to a separate section of the reimbursement statute is in part a response to the employer mandate under the Affordable Care Act. The section that we've put it under removes any impact of the limit on health insurance. So if you are over the limit as a result of providing health insurance, which you may not have in the past, or you may have increased what you're doing for employees through health insurance as a result of that mandate, that will be covered. That was one of the principles that we were trying to accomplish there. I'll also acknowledge that there's a drafting error in the bill that when we do amendments in a little while, we're going to address. You didn't mention this specifically, but family coverage is also not mentioned there. That was not intentional. We intend to allow family coverage as a fringe benefit, and we've also, very few employers currently cover part-time employees, so we're still deciding whether that's part of this part of the rate or whether that would be something that would go under the limit, but I think I could say we intend to address that as well. On the contributions to HSAs and HRAs, probably a little more complicated answer. I think those are employee benefits that are legitimate costs that we feel should be recognized in the rates if people are making those contributions as employers. On the question of high deductible health plans, whether people will continue to use high deductible health plans when you're in a payment system where your costs are being covered and where you can do a more traditional health plan more easily because you're being paid for it, you know, maybe that will become a very uncommon practice for employers in this in our sector. Right now, it's common enough that we feel like, and it is an employee benefit, so we feel it should be, acknowledged as a cost.
Representative Butler.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and I do think that in a business where many of the providers are for profit, and others have highly paid administrators and other management staff, even if they're organized as a nonprofit, assuming that with these increases they will devote it to a better benefit package, I think, is a leap of faith on the part of some. Others will. It's like any industry. You have some people who are really operate on one set of philosophies and another on another. And when we're going to not give many increases of 30% or more to anybody in this budget, those who get it have to be accountable. And the last question I'll just have, since today we're just trying to understand the proposal, is what is who qualifies as specialized facilities? Because it seems like these days everybody wants to say they're special, and I specialize in this group of patients, and I specialize in that group of special. And so how do you get to become a specialized care facility in your system as it's before us?
Mr. Bergstrom.
Yep. Madam Chair, Representative, we identified two specific types of specialized facilities. One is what is known under Minnesota rules, the Rule 80 facilities. So, for example, Courage Center, there's another center up in Duluth, there's one in Red Wing that traditionally serve under 65 in attempts to rehab persons in TBIs or accidents so that they can return to the community. And they've always enjoyed a special or higher rate because that's a different type of service that's provided. And then the other special facility is there's a Good Samaritan facility that provides care to people with Huntington's disease, which requires a lot more care than your typical nursing facility client.
Thank you.
Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And really, just to this point on the providing of the health care benefits, I think the questioning starts to border on, you know, when we think we should tell a business entity how to run their business, because it has a lot to do, in my mind, like rate equalization. We thought it was for protecting the people so that we're getting equal treatment, as opposed to allowing those who could pay more actually pay more, so that we could put more money into the system so that we could provide better benefits for everyone. But to the point specifically for health insurance, if you are trying to provide a zero deductible health care plan for all of your part-time people and your employees, wouldn't that cost significantly more?
Mr. Bostic?
Sure, Madam Chair. In general, there's a number of factors that would go into that, but yes, you know, a more comprehensive plan is more expensive. I think that's been one of the reasons why people have moved towards high deductible plans, is the savings on the premium, and then if you make a contribution to the employee's account, they can pay some of those costs up.
Representative Kelly.
And Madam Chair and Mr. Bostic, I would assume then if you could save some money on providing at least some health care to your employees, they would prefer that, and they would prefer that the savings there be pushed down to their salaries instead. Just an observation. Thank you.
Representative Dean.
Oh. Glad I can help, guys.
Give one moment. He's the last person with a question, so then we'll be wrapping up, I think.
Thank you, Madam
Chair. Sorry, Representative.
Sorry about that. I blame Representative Zerwas. I would like to first thank Representative Loeffler for digging into this, and would like to associate myself with her original comments regarding payment methodologies and the plight of folks paying out of pocket for this, and the differences in fairness as we look at this. And one of the big themes for this year is going to be fairness, and in trying to get things a little bit more fair for payers and for providers and for patients across Minnesota. When we look at skilled nursing facilities, we see that it hasn't been very fair in many cases over the past years, and we're trying to make it less unfair. I mean, it's still going to be unfair for people who are paying out of pocket versus those who are not. It's still going to be unfair for people in one geography versus another. We're trying to smooth it out, make it a little less unfair, and sometimes that's good enough. For Representative Schumacher, just kind of give us an update of where we are on the cost. I assume there's a small cost to this bill, and how we're going to be looking at that, both from the aggregate cost and then also from the banding of how this is going to create winners and losers, how that gets banded out, and how we project that out. And then lastly, I would just like to encourage you to really look at the definition of cost, because that really does affect how we perceive things as fair or unfair. And if we say the cost of care is X, and we were just talking about this earlier, it's a little overused. And it legislators' eyes kind of glaze over when you say cost. You just say we're 25% below cost and we're 65% below cost between our 1970 rates that we're still on. And it's true, but it kind of gets overused so that the impact really doesn't hit home for people. So I think with this, it is real. And how we really develop what those costs are and how we define them is going to be a big deal, because I want to make sure that we fund this year. I want to make sure we get it right. I want to make sure we get it as fair as we can. But it involves a lot of work on the definition of those costs and the definition of fairness moving ahead. So just give us a quick update on where you are in the dollars and also where you're going to be on accountability for the cost measure as well as the banding on winners and losers.
Representative Schumacher.
Okay, I can take the first part of that and go from there. Madam Chair, Representative Dean, the Senate has a fiscal note that was put together for their bill, which is very similar to the bill that we have in front of us, and they had a price tag of $196 million for the first biennium, and then it goes to $361 million in the out years for the facilities. So that's right now approximately where the cost would be. We haven't put in a fiscal note yet for the House side to get some adjustments there. We're trying to get some of the language that needs to be worked out, and we wanted to have the thorough hearing in committee here to make sure that we got the bill in the right spot before we got to that. But this really goes to recognize that when facilities are talking about how they're under funded, that they are, and to the tune of about $196 million a year. And that's really where we're at with this. It really highlights the fact that this isn't just hyperbole from the industry. This is really, they finally have a number put to it and what they are being under reimbursed for their cost of care right now. Can you guys take the other questions?
Mr. Bostic.
Thanks, Madam Chair. One of them was about, I believe it's described as banding in terms of the impact, the kind of the disparate impact on facilities of this. You know, we showed a little table here. You'll notice that the table is kind of weighted towards increases in the 15 to 30% range, if you will. So we're not overly concerned that there's going to be facilities that are unhappy with implementation of this system if we're fortunate enough to see that happen. We have put in a hold harmless for a handful of facilities who for a few historical reasons would not actually see any benefit of this bill. Our intent is that hold harmless would last them until their costs catch up to where their rates would be calculated under this system. So that's our current thinking about how to deal with that issue.
Representative Dean.
Thank you. Thanks for bringing it forward. Thanks for all your hard work on this, Representative Schumacher, and all the advocates, and look forward to seeing it down the trail.
Okay, members, I don't see any further questions at this point. And so thank you so much, testifiers, for being here. And members, this is certainly not the last that you'll be seeing of this bill. We will take it up and officially move on the bill where we can have amendments. But thank you for hanging around today and getting a better understanding of what we've all realized and known for a while is a very complicated issue. So thank you so much. Thank you, Representative Schumacher. And members, we are adjourned.